Hi, my name is Juliet, and I'm the host for this podcast. I'm studying to be a rabbi. In fact, I'll be ordained by next January, which is very exciting. And in Judaism, there's a specific portion, we call it a parsha, or reading from the Torah, which is the Hebrew Bible, for every week of the year. And as we go through these readings week by week in order from the beginning of the Torah to the end, from the beginning of the Jewish year to the end, we analyze the stories and we comment on them. Of course, connecting them to real life, to contemporary life, is how these ancient stories come alive, which is one of my great passions as a rabbi. I hope you'll accompany me as I tell these stories of Torah, of my life, and the lives of others. And if you miss an episode, you can always go back and find it wherever you get your podcasts. I love saying that. I sound so professional. I feel so professional. Anyway, thanks for coming on this ancient and contemporary journey with me. And you can always go to my website, lenegditamid.us, lenegditamid.us, and make a donation, although I give these podcasts freely. Donations are very much appreciated, so to support this work. So on to today's topic, the rejects of Amor. Every so often, I'm asked to explain myself. How did I get here, and why am I doing this work? How did I go from communist to rabbi? Yes, I grew up as a communist. My parents were communists. You can read about it on my website, lenegditamid.us. It was only about 10 years ago, you can read the full story on my website, but it was only about 10 years ago that I became a real shul goer, synagogue attender, really learning about how to pray, how to daven, what prayer meant, especially to find a meaning in the word God, to find a definition for myself. So how did I go from there, being a communist, growing up in a home where my parents and my entire community, everybody that I knew, most people that I knew or that my parents interacted with, rejected religion outright. They had disdain for religion in general, and if they were Jewish, in particular, for Judaism. I didn't really know anything about it. We appreciated where we came from, in terms of cultural, in a cultural way, which I think is very common, and rejected the rest. And I'm in a very different place now. So it's hard sometimes. Yesterday I saw a friend from 30 years ago. And I said, 10 years ago was like a real turning point for me. It was around 10 years ago that I decided I wanted to become a rabbi. And before that, I was just kind of dabbling in it, like you do with drugs, just kind of dabbling. I was experimenting and looking and searching. And so he saw this friend, and I was really nervous about seeing her because I thought, I knew that she was going to ask me that question. And I knew that she came from my previous life, and we understood each other then, for the most part. I mean, I was searching a little bit then, but it wasn't much, And so I knew she was going to ask me, and we spent the afternoon together, and we had a wonderful time reminiscing about the past, and remembering the pain and the joy, and filling each other in on our lives and our children as they've grown and unfolded. And towards the end, she finally did ask me, "So what inspired you on this path to become a rabbi?" And as I said, I was kind of dreading it. And I knew that my path was confounding her. And, just like it was my mother and anyone else in my previous life, my parents. So how could I explain in a nutshell how something as problematic as religion and the Judaism that we all rejected could bring me so much joy and healing, and that I could go so far as to want to become a leader in this. How does this ancient book, an ancient book like the Torah, with its all its dreadful, sexist, racist stories and rules, and don't even get me started on present-day politics in Israel, how does it give meaning to my life? A tribal religion based on a sacrificial system that has no meaning in our lives today. Take, for example, this week's Parsha, Amor. Say to the people, say to them. With its rules for priestly purity and sacrifice. For example, a priest cannot marry a woman defiled by harlotry, nor a divorced woman. No, quote, lame man who has a defect, that's per translation, like being blind or with a shorter limb, shorter arm or shorter leg, broken leg or broken arm, a hunchback, a dwarf. These are all considered, none of them is considered a full enough human being to make a sacrifice to God. The same goes for animals. None with any defect or blemish is worthy of sacrifice. They're all, both human and animal, rejects in God's eyes. But the worst is yet to come. When a daughter of a priest defiles herself through harlotry, I quote, she is to be burned to death, thrown into the fire. And a person who blasphemes God's name is to be stoned to death. Well, so it's understandable. This is the God that my ancestors, my parents, I don't know, you know, my grandparents on one side rejected. Probably even, yeah, they probably all like had mixed feelings about this God. But this is the way the ancients lived, right? It's not the way we moderns live. We have all the answers, right? Especially those of us who call ourselves progressives or liberal. We've got it all figured out. But are we? Are we modern? Do we have it all figured out? And what about the lame among us? It's so interesting how we use that word now, right? Like, oh, it's so lame. Oh, it's so lame. But think about where that came from. Do we look at disabled people with pity? Soon that's going to be something that we're not allowed to say. You can't use the word lame. Oh my God. Oh no, I think I started something. Anyway, do we look at disabled people with pity? Getting back to the seriousness of this. What expectations do we have of them? Are we respecting them through our laws? How much accessibility are we creating? Are things accessible enough? I think if you spoke to any person with a disability, they would tell you that we far, very far short of providing for their needs. And what about our attitude towards people who turn to prostitution in desperation? Talk about throwing people into the fire. I mean, how? And so on to other things which are in the news. Abortion was legalized in the U.S. only 50 years ago. I mean, it was 1972. Do I get the right year right? I think so. I was 10 years old. 1972. That's crazy. Like, I was already 10. I know 50 years ago may sound like a lot to a bunch of people, but to me, I was that age just yesterday. And now, strong political and religious forces, political/religious forces, are fighting hard to overturn this right to abortion. And yet the same forces ignore rape and abuse, and they could care less about providing sustenance to families of young children as lawmakers continually block legislation that could provide support. I mean, you're paying attention to the news, right? It's crazy. Then, now, there's this sudden and terrible shortage of baby formula that I was hearing about and reading about. There's a monopoly that three huge formula companies have on the market, plus our market economy that allows for such monopolies, giving companies the ability to pay low wages, to have this, because they have this monopoly, they can afford to pay low wages and charge high prices. And this not only is the beginning of the cause of the problem, but it exacerbates it. I mean, of course, the bacteria in the in the factory is the cause, but it's kind of like looking at our society and saying, oh, well, this coronavirus was caused by a virus. This pandemic was caused by a virus, but what is the real root of it? And what is the real root of it having spread so far and so wide? Right? You have to look deeper. You have to look much deeper. So getting back to formula, while women shouldn't be shamed for formula feeding and they shouldn't be blamed for it, and it's true that some women can't physically breastfeed, but it's also true that there's a terrible shortage of support for women who would like to breastfeed. I know it. I studied this. I was very involved in teaching people to breastfeed and learning about this and how bad it is. Women are just not given the support, even if they want to. And so very often they think they don't have enough milk, but that's not the case. Or even if they do, they could be helped to produce more milk. So that's a whole other thing. And this is not to mention that the hospitals support these mega, you know, companies, these huge formula companies, by notoriously sending women home from the hospital with free formula in spiffy little bags. I mean, I got one. I remember that. It was hard for me to, I was like, what am I supposed to do with this? I'm breastfeeding. And yet it kind of felt nice to have it. And it gets, you know, it makes you think about it. And doesn't this all tie into our expectations that I'm going to quote, like the way we talk, the way we hear politicians talk, all those mothers and people, all those mothers having all those babies they shouldn't be having. And also they shouldn't be so lazy and they should go to work at minimum wage jobs that can't pay their rising gas bills. So even if they wanted to breastfeed, they can't. Yeah, the political / religious forces are forcing women to have the babies they don't want to have, can't afford, and can't feed. And so I ask, aren't we still burning women alive, but in a different sense? And in another way, in our society, how well do our schools address learning disabilities? Do we still hear people, teachers included, and I did as when I was a teacher in public schools, don't we still hear people call children lazy instead of wondering what's getting in the way of their learning? Could it be a learning disability? Could it be a home situation? Could it be homelessness? Could it be, who knows? There are a million reasons why children put their heads down and just want to go to sleep. They might be depressed or fool around in class and distract other kids and get themselves in trouble. And how are we doing respecting other kinds of rejects of society? Respecting in this respect and do we respect them? Other rejects of society. How many homeless, drug-addicted, mentally ill people do you see on the street? I live in New York City, and I see many, many more in the past 2 years. So how's our healthcare system handling this problem? How are we doing here? And how are we each doing in terms of our own personal attitudes? Do we sneer at the drug addicts and prostitutes and think of them as less than so we can just walk on past and feel better about ourselves or a little bit less bad about not giving them money or not doing something more? And what if we live in a place where we don't see people like that and we don't want to see them? And do we use the excuse of blaming the parents who are the cause of the children being, quote, messed up? I mean, everybody came from, everyone was a child at one point. So do we have compassion for all involved instead of judging? Can we recognize that the parents are victims who were once children too, and who, if only we as a society gave them the proper support, well, things would be different. So, getting back to the original thoughts here, like the women in our society, it feels like I'm in a catch-22 situation. I recognize that the ancient books of my heritage are totally outdated, yet they still manage to inform me, to inform us, and reflect, and help us reflect on ourselves as a society. But even worse than that, they are a mirror. They serve as a mirror for our present day life and society. And as for the religion itself, its prayer books and spiritual practices, so much of that is antiquated as well. It needs updating as much as our sacred texts do. And I don't agree with the opinions and practices of many other Jews, probably most other Jews, which makes it a real big struggle for me. But I have my community that's on the same page with me, and we find strength in each other and in singing together. And when I feel like all is for naught and my hope has been drained, I find strength in praising the miracle and the mystery that I am still here despite everything, and for all the blessings in my life, and I do see them as blessings. Why should I not be able, this is what I ask myself, why should I not be able to take joy in my heritage just because of others who have tried to exclude me as a woman? Why can't I take ownership of it and redirect it to something new and renewed? Because we can't throw away the world we have. We have to renew it as well. And we can't deny where we come from. We don't live in a vacuum. And finally, I come full circle, and I'm reminded that throughout time, we have always had underground movements. Just like the underground abortion movement is resurging. You can hear about that on the podcast, The Experiment. I think it's also on the media, both NYC podcasts. And the underground abortion movement is beginning to surge again, out of necessity. The oppressed, the enslaved, the downtrodden have always found ways of getting around the restrictions. We will find a way. We always do. And let us say amen. Thanks for being here with me today, this week. And I'll see you next week. Good Shabbos. Bye. Hi, my name is Juliet, and I'm the host for this podcast. In January, I will be ordained as a rabbi through Aleph, the Jewish Renewal Ordination Program. And in Judaism, there's a specific portion or reading, we call it a parsha, from the Torah, which is the Hebrew Bible, for every week of the year. And as we go through these readings week by week in order from the beginning of the Torah to the end, from the beginning of the Jewish year to the end, we analyze the stories and we comment on them. Of course, connecting them to real life, to contemporary life, is how these ancient stories come alive, which is one of my great passions as a future rabbi, well, as a rabbi. I hope you'll accompany me as I tell these stories of Torah and of my life and the lives of others. And if you miss an episode, you can always go back and find it wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for coming on this ancient and contemporary journey with me. And you can always go to my website, lenegditamid.us, lenegditamid.us, to give donation, to check out all of the other things that I offer, like, for instance, spiritual direction, hashba'ah, life cycles, anything that... Yeah, everything. Just go and check it out, okay? So, on to today's podcast. I'm calling this My People, My Mountain. Well, if there's one sentence I wish we could all believe in and live by from the Torah, it would be, the land does not belong to you, it is mine. Yes, that's God speaking as usual, and it's repeated several times in this week's Parsha. The book of Leviticus is known for being chock full of laws given over to the Israelite people through Moses on Mount Sinai. It's the least liked book of the five books of Moses, which make up our Torah. And this week, Bahar, meaning on the mountain, is no exception. Bahar is all about the laws of Shemitah and Yovel, that's the sabbatical year, and the Jubilee, which is every 7th and 50th year. These allow the land and the people to rest, and all the possessions, including houses and slaves, to return to their original owners, or to go free and return to their families, respectively. The houses go back, and the land goes back to the people, the original owners, and the people get to go home to their families and are freed from slavery. Not like the American slavery system, which was, I think I was told, was very original in history, because all throughout history, slaves were not necessarily seen as one, inferior people, or unworthy of being, you know, freed. People took over each other's land and they took slaves and they all treated each other badly, but you got to go back. You got to be freed. You could believe that one day you would be freed. So of course I understand why this law of Shemitah and Yovel has never been followed. It's not only inconvenient for the farmer, and it may not even be possible to accomplish such a feat as saving enough grain and other food during the first 6 years of the cycle to have enough for the 7th year. I mean, in fact, that question has been brought forth by religious people, leaders, like, could we really do this? But aside from that, the second part about letting all slaves go free and land and houses return to their original owners, well, I don't know that they didn't. I think they did free slaves, but they didn't return houses. I don't know. But what can I say about this other than it's also extremely inconvenient? And yes, I'm being sarcastic. It's inconvenient for those who hold the wealth and the power to return their holdings. They not only don't want to let it go, but they actually don't have to because nobody's making them. And obviously I'm talking about nowadays. And I wonder again, like, we have no proof, I think, and somebody out there can correct me, that this was ever followed, Shemitah and Yovel. But it's a really good idea. Kind of the way people talk about communism and socialism. It was a good idea, but didn't work out so well. It doesn't mean that we can't aspire to such a thing, though, of allowing all people to have more or less the same access to wealth and not having such extremes as we have, more and more extremes these days. And it makes me think of the gun laws in the U.S. and the filibuster left over from Jim Crow. I know everybody heard about the mass shooting in Buffalo, New York last week. And there's this thing called the filibuster, which is, oh my God, can I repeat it? You can have the majority of senators voting, you know, in favor of a law or in Congress, but you still have to have more than that. You have to have 60 as opposed to 51, I think are the numbers, in order to pass the law. So this filibuster thing, and I'm probably not even explaining it properly, so you should go look it up yourself. But the point is that the filibuster is holding us back from changing laws that are bad for the majority of people. And it allows these laws to continue as they are. I mean, you know, the craziness of the guns and the killing. Like, who needs, honestly, who needs a semi-automatic rifle? My husband said, a killer. Yeah, not a hunter, right? I mean, it's insane what's going on. But you know all that already. So anyway, getting back to, you can also go to Democracy Now! To hear more about the filibuster and the discussion today, Thursday, May 17th. Oh God, what's today's date? Anyway, it was on democracynow.org. I recommend listening to learn about the filibuster and how we need to overcome it. But so also, you know, we don't just have a problem with guns in this country and being able to, although the majority of Americans would like to see the gun laws changed and for there to be more protections against, well, racist and mentally ill people having guns and having these kinds of guns. The same is true for abortion laws. The majority of Americans don't want abortion rights overturned. And yet, we have a minority who has the power that's controlling things. So getting back to the land, we're talking about people. But the way we possess and treat our land reflects the way we treat our people, and vice versa. The way we treat people also reflects the way we possess and treat our land. And as we know, some people are apparently more important than others. I'm being sarcastic, yes. And so there was this really interesting episode on This American Life last week called My Lying Eyes. And it examines different situations in which people refuse or just can't. They just can't see what's blatantly in front of them. And one of them is about climate change and the climate crisis and this family that was displaced by the fires in Paradise in California. And yet the families are like, oh no, there's no such thing as climate change. And then there's another story about the Ukrainian refugees versus Latin American refugees at the Mexican border. And, you should really listen to it. It's a really good episode. It shows how the refugee camps for Latin Americans at the Mexican border are so lacking in goods and services. And the ones that were set up for Ukrainians had all these donations. And the Ukrainians, oh, very short time, right? Only, yes, we're coming on 3 months of this war, but apparently, and I don't know exactly what the laws are now, but they were allowed in. And there was these refugee camps closed down. The ones for the Ukrainians and the Latin Americans who had nothing and have been there for years, and they're also escaping war, and yet they're not being allowed into the country, as we know, at the rate that the Ukrainians are. And the Ukrainians, it's like all of a sudden they just like, okay, you can come in. So of course my heart aches for Ukrainians fleeing for their lives. And we're coming, like I said, we're coming on 3 months of this war, and it's horrible. And we don't want to see it going on for years. And I'm happy that so many people have sprung forth with donations for the victims of this war. And that U.S. borders have opened for the refugees. Oh my God. Then I heard this other report yesterday that I was on the radio. All these African medical students that were in Ukraine are not being allowed into the U.S. the way, and they can't just go home. Like people say, oh, just go home. They can't just go home. It's the same, different for different reasons. They can't just go home. Their families have given all that, like they've pooled all their money so that their children can go to medical school. And there's nothing left. Like, they're supporting them, you know, they're really good students. But they're not being allowed into the U.S. They're not being considered Ukrainian refugees. So the unfairness of this, my heart aches for Latino refugees as well, though, fleeing war. For years they've been fleeing war. It's not just the climate. They're not just climate refugees. As we know, there's a terrible drug war going on. And these people's lives are at risk. They cannot stay where they are. Well, if there's anything that the Bible and religion are good for today, as I discussed last week, it's to examine ourselves, our beliefs, and to be a reflection of the society we live in today. If not, to reflect the kind of society we aspire to build as well. So I ask the question, how are we blinded, not just as a society, but as individuals as well, to the suffering of those that are not like us? This week's Parsha, as throughout the Torah, also has the commandment to welcome and include the stranger as much as our own. It says it over and over again. And it's human nature to care more about our own families and communities, to care about our own people first. But we're at a time of reckoning, really, where we're being asked to care about those beyond our own people. I was thinking of the Woody Guthrie song, "This Land Is Your Land." Actually, a friend reminded me of it, and how the original lyrics did not make it into popular, you know, parlance or whatever. Like, most people don't know these words, but here are the last verses. I'm going to try to sing them. I'm not sure if I got them, you know, the rhythm exactly right, but here goes. As I went walking, I saw a sign there, and on the sign it said no trespassing. But on the other side, it didn't say nothing. That side was made for you and me. In the shadow of the steeple, I saw my people by the relief office. By the relief office, I seen my people. As they stood there, see, I messed it up. As they stood there hungry, I stood there asking, is this land made for you and me? Nobody living can ever stop me as I go walking that freedom highway. Nobody living can ever make me turn back. This land was made for you and me. Okay, that wasn't so bad. So I want to end with, can we expand our definition of my people? What are my people? Who are my people? And what is my land? Because I think the world depends on it. And let us say amen. And thank you for being here with me this week. And see you next week.